Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the most current July 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article I didn't get to last week, which is a short interview with Justin Haywood of the Moody Blues. And then an article about guitarist Rory Gallagher since his death 30 years ago, and a classic album review of American 4 by Johnny Cash. Here's a short interview with Moody Blues singer Justin Haywood. The Moody Blues singer talks his old band, cover versions, and Clifford T. Ward. Speaking from Monaco, Justin Haywood is telling Mojo about his debt to Human League vocalist Phil Oakley. He had a way of singing that I learned a lot from in the 80s, he says, which he probably quite sorry about. Self-deprecating and humorous. Haywood was born in Swindon in 1946 and joining Birmingham's The Moody Blues in 1966, facilitating their shift from R&B into boldly progressive directions. He wrote their eternal signature, Nights in White Satin, in 1967, with that year's Days of Future Past, the first of seven extraordinary LPs recorded in their first 67 to 72 flush. And here's a little bit of that famous song from the Moody Blues, Nights in White Satin.
Nights in white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written, never meaning to send. Beauty I'd always missed with these eyes before. Just what the truth is, I can't say anymore, 'cause I love you.
Haywood found extra household fame with his 1978 hit Forever Autumn, recorded solo albums, and forged on with the Moody's until 2018. Now he's back with a Mike Batt team-up and a UK tour scheduled for October. You've just done an orchestral cover of the Dream Academy's Life in a Northern Town with Mike Batt. Mike Batt and myself did an album called Classic Blue with the London Philharmonic in 1989, and we nearly did it then. We had another opportunity last year, a three-hour session, and this was at the top of our list. I didn't go back and listen to the Dream Academy version. I wanted to do the song as I remembered it. I hope you know songwriters Gilbert Gabriel and Nick Lard Clouds like it, or at least don't mind it. When people cover Nights in White Satin, I get asked, did you like it? Well, I don't mind it. That's about the best we can hope for, I think, with a cover. Something in your version recalls the late Clifford T. Ward, who you've also previously covered. It's his very English, lyrical way, I think. Maybe that's what it has in common. I knew Clifford T., and I was always a fan. To be in his company was very, very special. he left us much too soon. Are the Moody Blues properly done? I don't know what the answer to that one is. There's only me and Lodgy, bassist John Lodge, left. When Graham, Edge drummer, died in 2021, it really affected me. He loved the group so much. Me and John, we always had things outside of the band, but Graham devoted his whole life to it. And I just think some of that particular magic is gone. I don't want to be in a tribute band. Actually, that's not fair. I'm just saying that when Graham passed, the enthusiasm for it changed. And I'm really liking what I do now. The band fitted into the progressive bracket with concepts and mellotrons, but you connected with audiences beyond it. There was always melody. At the heart of it was a pop song. That came home to me when we were on The Simpsons in 1999. Matt Groening told us that Homer was a Moody Blues fan, which I accepted because we played to Homer throughout America, you know, for all of those years. Those songs clearly resonated. Did you ever go on the Knights in White Satin, the trip fairground ride at Hard Rock Park in South Carolina? I did, very spooky, like the ghost train when you were a kid. There was an Eagles ride as well. We played on the same night at the concert to open the place. I think the owner's concept was, if you build it, people will come. But there was no infrastructure, no airport, so they didn't. You've done the On the Blue cruise, blue guitar. Does the color blue have significance for you? Well, it's something that a promoter will hang on you, but I remember right at the beginning, Mike Pender Keyboards was hung up with a record called Mood Indigo. And so there was always that aura around us of blue that stuck. My life is color-coded, though, certain things on certain days, and I don't think I'm unusual in that. Today is green. What's tomorrow? Orange. Is there a blue day? Oh, yes. But I'm gonna have to leave it hanging there. Over a lifetime in music, how do you stay sane? Well, if I can call myself sane, the one thing with the Moody's was people knew the music, but we were never celebrities. We were a bit snooty about letting the music do the talking, so there was never star pressure. I did have my time when I would get recognized, particularly around when Forever Autumn was a hit. But that passes. Here's a little bit of that song, Forever Autumn, by Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues.
The summer sun is fading as the year grows old, and darker days are drawing near. The winter winds will be much colder now you're not here. Watch the birds fly south across the autumn sky, and one by one they disappear. I wish that I was flying with them. Now you're not here. Like the sun through the trees, came to love me.
Tell us something you've never told an interviewer before. I don't know. I haven't had my dinner yet. And now I move on to the article about guitarist Rory Gallagher, titled, They Don't Make Them Like You Anymore. 30 years since his death in June 1995, the cult of Rory Gallagher thrives in the music of his fans and the stories of his bandmates. A creative dynamo blending blues, rock, folk, and more. A beautiful man who is also a dictator. A doomed loner who would rip up an album rather than compromise his art. He wouldn't sacrifice anything for the purity of the music. Deep Purple bassist Roger Glover will never forget that night during the making of Calling Card, the album he produced for Rory Gallagher in 1976, the first the fiercely single-minded Irishman had allowed an outsider to oversee. Rory was doing a very convincing impression of a preacher making a sermon and urging the audience to repent for their sins and come to the Lord, Glover recalled. This went on well into the night, aided and abetted by drink and laughter. That's what made Rory a great stage performer, his ability to entertain whatever the occasion. The pair had met when Purple took Gallagher out on a U.S. tour in 1973. As in Britain and Europe, the Irishman's sweltering hard rock blues had blown audiences away. Technically brilliant, emotionally raw, entertaining whatever the occasion. But while Gallagher's live Irish tour 74 had sold 2 million, none of his previous 5 studio albums made the UK or US top 10. And no one track defined him in the manner of, say, Deep Purple's Smoke on the Water. To many ears, Calling Card had maximized the guitarist's commercial potential. As Gallagher's keyboardist Lou Martin put it, it has a marvelous sound, fantastic songs. In my opinion, everything is perfect. But Gallagher wasn't happy. He thought Glover had sanded down too many of his edges and, behind the producer's back, had Rolling Stones engineer Chris Kimsey remix the tapes. Gallagher also refused to allow his record label Chrysalis to edit the gorgeous, dynamic, edged in blue for a single. Didn't they know Gallagher didn't release singles? To ram the point home, Gallagher wrote Last of the Independents, a key song on his next album, Photo Finish. Here's a little bit of that song, The Last of the Independents, by Rory Gallagher. Seasoned producer Elliot Mazur was employed before Gallagher dropped the finished tapes in a hotel bin as his manager, Brother Donal, stood by, slack-jawed. Nearby, Chrysalis executives gathered to preview the album. I asked Rory, can I just play them a couple of tracks? Donal tells Mojo Today. No, he said, I did want to kill him, but he'd made his mind up. Before re-recording Photo Finish from scratch, Gallagher sacked Lou Martin and drummer Rod Dioff, leaving only bassist Gary McGow of the lineup that most Gallagher aficionados believe was his all-time best. The impetus had been witnessing, of all bands, Sex Pistols in San Francisco, and craving for himself that rough-edged assault behind Johnny Rotten. Rory said, "I don't know if that's the best or worst gig I've ever seen," recalls Dunall. "But that's the closest thing to Eddie Cochran I'll ever see." From a record company point of view, Rory was unmanageable because he was so strict in what he wanted, reflects Mark Feldham, Gallagher's live harmonica foil in the 80s and 90s. He wouldn't sacrifice anything for the purity and form of the music. Rory was a complex character, says Brendan O'Neill, Gallagher's drummer from 1981 to 1990. "If I was to sum him up in one word, it would be sensitive. He could be aggressive, particularly on stage, but he was an intelligent man, very well read, and, to me, a tortured soul. The creative energy that made Rory was also part of his demise." Everyone who talks to Mojo about Rory Gallagher, 30 years since his death, aged just 47, following a failed liver transplant, shares a mixture of immense fondness and intense regret. "A tragic loss, absolutely," says O'Neill. "There was just no one like him," says Feldham. "That loss is visibly felt across his home country. In 1997, 2 years after he passed, a sculpture, an unusual affair combining a guitar and strands of lyrics, was erected in the renamed Rory Gallagher Place in the city of Cork. Next was a more traditional bronze of his iconic 1961 Fender Stratocaster in Dublin's Temple Bar. The Rory Gallagher Music Library opened in Cork in 2004. In 2006, a plaque was laid at Belfast Ulster Hall, scene of several legendary Gallagher shows. The first statue of the man himself in bronze was unveiled in Ballyshannon, Gallagher's birthplace, on the border with Northern Ireland, while the town's annual blues festival bears his name. And in case a plaque isn't sufficient, another life-size bronze appeared in January this year, close to the Ulster Hall. By all accounts, Gallagher made an indelible mark on Irish hearts by insisting he play in Belfast at the height of the Troubles. Rory was the only one who'd played Belfast through the 70s, says O'Neill. The city had given him his first venture into blues. "We never talked about it, but I think Rory was anti the power that be, whichever side of the border. But the rumors, like he was a pallbearer at Bobby Sands' funeral, are ridiculous. Gallagher never took sides in public, nor talked about his Catholic faith. When David Coverdale visited the Munich studio where Calling Card was being recorded, the Deep Purple singer noted there was books all over on Catholicism. In fact, Gallagher shied away from public pronouncements of any sort. I really don't lead a very spectacular life, and so it is really more interesting to ask me about my music and my guitar," he told NME's Keith Aldam. "I haven't many interesting things to say about myself that I would want printed." In addition to Catholicism, music ran in Gallagher's family's DNA. His father, Danny, was a former Ulster champion accordionist and the band leader of the Inishowen Cecil Dance Orchestra. Mother Monica sang and acted with Ballyshannon's Abby Players. After she and Danny separated, Monica and her sons moved in with her parents in Cork, where the emerging teen guitarist found inspiration in skiffle king Lonnie Donegan, and through Donegan, the blues. In Ireland, the church was all-consuming, says O'Neill, but when Rory heard Muddy Waters, it blew his mind, and blues music became all-consuming for him instead. In 1963, age 15, Gallagher found the vehicle for his new obsession, a 1961 Fender Strat, for a then whopping 100 pounds. Later, it was stolen from a tour van, and later still, after a TV appeal, recovered from a ditch. He always referred it as his lucky charm. The same year, he joined the six-piece Fontana Show Band on lead guitar, playing popular hits in ballrooms and dance halls most evenings. An early sign of Rory's independent streak was refusing to wear the show band's uniform, which had been an absolute must. "That's how you got booked," says Donal. Gallagher spiced the show band material with R&B licks before going it alone, taking the rhythm section of local beat combo, The Axles. Bassist Norman Damery and drummer Eric Kinningham to form Taste. In December 1966, promoter and soon manager Eddie Kennedy secured Taste a residency at the Maritime Hotel, Belfast equivalent of Liverpool's Cavern Club, where them had laid down their marker. Kennedy insisted Gallagher hire a new rhythm section, drummer John Wilson and bassist Richard McCracken, both Belfast boys, before Taste were signed to Polydor. While there were similarities and label mates with label mates Cream, the differences were also marked. Rory would bring country licks, Celtic folk, and his show band background into the blues, notes Mark Feltham. No one else was doing that. At Eric Clapton's request, Taste supported Cream at their Royal Albert Hall farewell concerts in 1968 and toured the U.S. with Blind Faith the same year, just as Taste's self-titled album was released. 1970's follow-up, On the Boards, showed Gallagher was hungry to progress, feeding in jazz licks and playing alto sax on It's Happened Before, It'll Happen Again. Gallagher wasn't just a guitar hero, but an emerging singer-songwriter. The full package, says Gallagher fanatic and modern blues master Joe Bonamassa. He had a very underrated voice, too, with a higher range than most people think. With all the pieces in place, Taste looked set to emulate Cream's popularity. But the colorful Kennedy, carrying a cricket bat a la Ian Faith, turned from their savior to jailer, siphoning off money. It turned out he owed Taste and had leased them to Polydor, and turning band members against each other. Despite their killer performance at 1970's Isles of Wight Festival, the trio were no longer talking. Their subsequent breakup was traumatic, Gallagher admitted, adding, "The press all attacked me as if I was some kind of dictator." If no despot, Gallagher was eager to maintain control, although Led Zeppelin manager Peter Grant negotiated him a new solo deal with Polydor. The guitarist rejected Grant's offer to stay involved. Rory would have been an absolute superstar if he had someone like that looking after his career, contends Feltham. He had also declined replacing Clapton and Cream. Instead, he appointed road manager Donal as his de facto manager and sought out bassist Jerry McGowie and drummer Wilger Campbell from Belfast combo Deep Joy who had supported Taste at London's Marquee. "I'd seen Taste in Belfast," recalls McGarry. "One Saturday, I saw him in Crimble's music store. I plucked up the courage to say hello. He was so gentle and said, 'Come, sit down.' I said I was trying to make it in a band, and he said, 'Practice and play with as many people as you can.' 2 years on, he's calling me. Fancy coming to London for a bit of a jam?" In 1971, before the new trio played live, Gallagher released his self-titled solo debut, a masterly progressive blues statement that lent as much on songwriting as it did on a Stratocaster. Amid the Chicago and Delta homages, Laundromat anticipated both Thin Lizzy and Dr. Feelgood, while the Burt Janet's folk mood of Just the Smile, the country licks on it, It's You, and the West Coast vibes of Can't Believe It's True suggested a one-man Led Zeppelin III. Here's some of the song Can't Believe It's True by Rory Gallagher.
Can't believe it's true, I can't believe it's true. Baby, where are you? Baby, where are you? Clock on the wall, why do you bother to chime at all? Clock on the wall.
Rory loved Arthur Lee, The Doors, says McGowell. Dylan was a hero too. Rory was enjoying the situation, looking forward to the future. The upswing continued at a lightning pace. A second solo album, Deuce, also released in 1971, was recorded in under a week. Rory wanted to get down low and make something rough as hell, says McGow. 1973 albums Tattoo and Blueprint followed in the same vein. The latter recorded with new drummer Rod DeElf. Non-stop touring had triggered Wilger Campbell's fear of flying, and Lou Martin, as Gallagher's mercurial blend kept developing, epitomized by the dreamy, expansive daughter of the Everglades. Here's a little bit of that song, Daughter of the Everglades, by Rory Gallagher.
Down in the lowland, where the air is dark and sinister, the night there's no safe place to stand. Tries to peak voices I can't understand. Flamingos playing endlessly into the silent sky. Daughter of the Everglades, your mama before you walk and swim. Learn to make that snake tail stew from your daddy crazy talking.
Where did that song come from, wonders Donal Gallagher. Rory's reputation as a guitar player tended to overshadow his talent as a songwriter and as a lyricist. Rory knew this air hostess or he'd read a book, and they combined in this mysterious girl in the Deep South who possibly drowned. Through crime, pulp fiction, and film noir were Rory's favorite subjects, he saw the hidden intelligence, the double takes of people's characters. Gallagher, too, had something of that layered personality. The man of the people guitar hero, but also the quiet man, prone to solitude and intensely private. I knew Rory as the guy on stage, but not more than that, recalls Mark Feltham. To me, he was almost a man of the cloth. Everything seemed to be guided by his Catholic faith. I never heard him swear ever, which is very unusual in this world. Gallagher had his stage show nailed, gathering an army of passionate fans, but was growing more and more frustrated in the studio. He would take no more than 2 weeks to make an album, but still struggled to channel the excitement of his gigs. If Rory didn't have somebody to look at, he couldn't feed off the energy, said Lou Martin. That's why the Irish Tour 74 album is so bloody good, because he got the crowd singing and urging him along. By his fifth album, Against the Grain, his first for Chrysalis, Gallagher had toured the U.S. 20 times, regularly played for 2 to 3 hours. The album cover was a close-up of Gallagher's already battered Stratocaster, the paint peeled off with age, and the guitarist's sweat. The title underlined his need to go his own way. I see music as a lifetime affair. I'm not in it for the big kill and then get out, he said. I know we're not going to cut it on the smoke bomb, dry ice kick. We have a niche, and we're staying there. So why did Gallagher hire Roger Glover for Calling Card? McGough isn't sure. Rory never shared his motivations, and it wasn't my place to ask. He was the governor, but I do think it's one of his strongest records. The audience sizes we played to lifted after that, but Rory still preferred smaller venues, like 3,000 to 4,000, rather than the arenas. Still, Calling Card didn't perform as expected. By the time it was remixed and released, says Dunal, it was too close to Christmas, fighting other releases. But Rory still honored the tour dates, the live animal that he was. Life was at high speed. As Dunal explains, Photo Finish's title was not plucked out of the air. It just, and only just, made the deadline. With opening tracks, Shin Kicker and Brute Force and Ignorance, further aligning Gallagher with punk, the album was a back-to-basics triumph. But life at high speed began to impact negatively. And here's some of the song Brute Force and Ignorance by Rory Gallagher.
Survivors from the lost and found.
All, when production's an issue, you need more studio time to keep gilding the lily. It became a nightmare for Rory. Recording ran later into the night, and he wouldn't sleep as much. But he just kept gigging. He needed his fix to perform. McGough, recording through the night, I could hear darkness coming into the sound. No one remembers exactly when Gallagher developed his own fear of flying or started taking prescription drugs to manage it. The turbulence on some flights could be horrendous, says Dunall. One into Salt Lake City, the plane dropped so much, Rory and I shook hands. Despite his unbending attitude, Chrysalis still believed in Gallagher. They promised to make him a top priority, says Dunall, a phrase Gallagher took for his next album title. Except for the electric sitar decorating Philby, Gallagher's ode to British double agent Kim, top priority was a less inventive dose of power trio blues, while his voice was raspier and losing its higher register. McGough started to notice his governor was ailing. I could see how a couple of after-show drinks would affect Rory more than it should have. I realize now it wasn't so much the drink, but the mix with the medication. McGough also noticed Gallagher getting angrier at times, especially with drummers. At one German festival, Rory was giving Ted McKenna a hard time, and at the end of Bulldog Blues, a bass drum flew past my head. Ted has kicked his kit off the stage. Ted left in 81, but I think more because he wanted to do something else. McKenna's replacement was Brendan O'Neill, McGough's bandmate in Deep Joy. The new drummer couldn't help but notice the difference in Gallagher's personality on and off stage. He was a loner, says O'Neill. He never had a steady girlfriend, for example, I think because he was afraid to relinquish control over his destiny. His anxiety was always there. But whatever was on his mind, as soon as Rory walked on stage, it was gone. He'd sprint the last meters to the mic, shout, "Yeah!" and hit the first chord. Connected, or not, to Gallagher's fluctuating health, a three-year gap separated top priority and 1982's Jinx. It was another 5 years to Defender, the first on Gallagher's own label, Capo, after he'd wearied of major labels' empty promises. Both Jinx and Defender are fan favorites, doubling down on pure blues rock, matched by gigs that now featured Mark Feltham from South London's R&B's Nine Below Zero. Feltham loved the music, but feared for Gallagher. Irish musicians were huge drinkers, which I wasn't used to. But who was I to tell a superstar, "You're going to kill yourself one day"? He was such a beautiful man, but it messed up his mind and his decision-making. Gallagher had two goes at making fresh evidence, plus two remixes and three separate attempts to master it, taking 6 months in all. Released in 1990, the album featured guest instrumentation, including accordion, brass, and a returning Lou Martin, and a new detour with Cajun-flavored The King of Zydeco. There was fresh evidence, too, of Gallagher's state of mind in his lyrics. Heaven's Gate, he admitted, depicted a man haunted in a room in a terrible condition. Another track was titled Walkin' Wounded. Here's some of that song, Walkin' Wounded, by Rory Gallagher.
Mm-hmm.
his last years, Rory was slipping away, says Dunal. He still had to be fit to perform that many hours on stage, and he'd still greet every fan who hung out after. I tried to get him on a healthy diet because he had severe stomach pains. 1990 proved pivotal. Dunal finally convinced his brother to go to a clinic. Rory was furious but stayed the course, and that's when I learned about the pills. I'd only been focused on the alcohol before. McGovern and O'Neill resigned. It wasn't easy, says O'Neill. It was the best Rory had played in years, and he was keeping drinking to a minimum. But we needed to spread our wings. With his rhythm section joining Nine Below Zero, Gallagher found other musicians for what would be his last world tour in 1991. It wasn't the same vibe anymore, says Feltham. McGow would call him every Christmas, and eventually I found out how ill he was. But it was still a complete shock when I heard he had passed away. It's not possible, I said. Amongst Gallagher's lieutenants, Feltham was the closest. Dunal called, Mark, have you time to see Rory? The transplant hasn't taken, and he slipped into a coma. The consultant thought it a good idea to play some harmonica for Rory, to hope we'd get a response, but it didn't. I went back, and it was a lovely day, with a shaft of light on his bed. The consultant said it could be his last day. At Gallagher's funeral in Cork, McGow remembers a huge corsage. All along the road, thousands of people. Lou Martin played piano, and Mark played harmonica. Amazing grace, Feltham confirms, but at the graveside, not in the chapel. Then I threw the harmonica down the hole. 30 years on, he's anything but forgotten. Johnny Marr and The Edge, whose first big gig, age 15, was Gallagher at the Macroom Mountain Dew Festival in 1977, a test to his influence. There are the statues and anniversary shows and a vigorous ongoing campaign of archive releases, coordinated by Gallagher's nephew, Daniel. In 2024, his 1961 Strat sold to Irish concert promoters Dennis Desmond and Mike Adamson for a now whopping £700,000. And bidders queued for a chance to own other guitars from his armory. The sale promoted by YouTube videos with Joe Bonamassa. The Fontaines DC's, Carlos O'Connell, and others. Rory's ambition was to be a musician, the best at what he did, says Dunal. Younger musicians don't necessarily follow his music, but they follow his inspiration. He still has the most loyal fans a man can have, and that's why I still work with Rory. We're still up to our ears finding new recordings of his. I'm letting the genie back out of the bottle. And here's a side article. It was his rawness and intent. Modern blues master Joe Bonamassa on Rory Gallagher's unique attitude, as told to Martin Ashton. A lot of American blues players were influenced more by Britain and Ireland. Players like Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Peter Green, Gary Moore, and Rory. We heard them before we heard Howlin' Wolf or Son House. Rory's one of my heroes. The first track of his I heard was Cradle Rock from the Tattoo album. Like, what is this? But I have a bunch of favorites. I Wonder Who, Tattooed Lady, Who's That Coming? And here's some of the song Cradle Rock by Rory Gallagher. We'll be right back. What made Rory special was his rawness and intent. He never let off the gas. He was just flooring it. He meant every phrase and every word. My family were very blue-collar, and his music really resonated. I don't consider him a blues guitarist. He was a rock artist using a lot of blues, but also Irish folk. Even his acoustic stuff is amazing, and his lyrics are steeped in stories. You can hear how Thin Lizzy borrowed from Taste and his early solo albums. There was a real scene developing with everyone looking to Rory, their hero. I played Rory's 61 Stratocaster on stage. That's a lot of fun. He loved that guitar. You can tell he played it all of the time by the way the contours had worn to the shape of his hands on the neck. When it was up for auction, I'm glad it stayed in Ireland. It's not just an instrument, it's a symbol, like a Stradivarius violin. When I got the call about playing the tribute show for the 30th anniversary of Rory's passing in Cork, I thought, dude, what an honor. Then I realized what I was getting myself into, because you realize how much his music means to people, especially in Ireland. I think it's going to be tougher than I bargained for. I'm not Rory, I'm just a fan. But you do the best you can. It'll be my version of Rory. I hope Jerry McGavery will join us on bass for a couple of tunes for the Cork shows. He's still out there killing it. The more, the merrier. It's a tribute, so I want to do this right. There's only one 30th anniversary for Rory. Now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's Johnny Cash, American Four, The Man Comes Around. In 1993, rap metal producer Rick Rubin invited veteran country maverick Johnny Cash to make a stripped-down back-to-basics record in Rubin's L.A. living room. The record that followed, American Recordings, went on to win a Grammy. In the years between his 60th and 70th birthdays, Cash completed the trilogy with two further albums reflecting increasingly upon religion and mortality. Still, nobody was quite ready for The Man Comes Around. Beset by a desperately debilitating illness, misdiagnosed first as Parkinson's disease, then as Shy-Dranger syndrome, and finally defined as anatomic neuropathy, I think it means you're getting old and shaky, he smiled, Cash dredged the record from his frail frame by sheer force of will. I found strength to work on this album just to spite this disease, he said. I came to the studio sometimes with no voice, when I could have stayed home and pouted, but I couldn't let that happen. I recorded when that was the last thing in the world I thought I could do. And there's a great deal of strength coming out of that weakness. Like the three previous installments, The Man Comes Around was recorded with sparse acoustic instruments, mainly in Rubin's L.A. home, but augmented by sessions at Cash's home studio in Tennessee. And a tumultuous version of Danny Boy was cut in 2 hours at St. James Church Episcopal Cathedral in L.A. Here's a little bit of that song, Danny Boy, by Johnny Cash.
Oh, Danny Boy, the pipes are calling. From glen to glen and down the mountainside, The summer's gone and all the roses fallen. It's you must go and I must bide. But come ye back when summer's in the meadow, or when the valley's hushed and white with snow. I'll be here in sunshine or in shadow.
The singer, his producer, friends and family contributed ideas for songs to record, but the final cuts clearly represent the apogee of Cash's career-long obsession with God, death, and redemption. Although most of the songs were covers, Cash's versions left the originals looking redundant by discarding what he felt was irrelevant. He turned each performance into something dark, mysterious, and haunted. This approach was best exemplified in his Bone Bare readings of Nine Inch Nails' Hurt and Depeche Mode's Personal Jesus. Hurt is a song about a man's pain and what we're capable of doing to ourselves, Cash reflected. And here's a little bit of that song, Hurt by Johnny Cash.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend.
Everyone. Cash reflected, I could relate to that from the very beginning. Personal Jesus is probably the most evangelical gospel song I ever recorded. I don't know that the writer meant it to be that, but that's what it is. In the title track, Cash contributed his best self-penned song for years, a brooding gem studded with apocalyptic menace. I firmly believe that it's the best record we've done, he said upon its release. It reaches out even farther than the others did. It goes in so many different directions. We take no prisoners. We do it the way we want to. And we look forward to the work to be done, defiant to the last. And here's a little bit of the title track, The Man Comes Around by Johnny Cash.
As it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts saying, come and see. And I saw, and behold, a white horse.
There's a man going round taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around. The hairs on your arm will stand up at the terror in each sip and in each sup. Will you partake of that last offered cup or disappear into to the...
Fortunately, once again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the July 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. Start off with an article about the Grateful Dead 60 years ago, and then, in June 1963, how girl groups take over. And a classic album review of Bob Dylan's Nashville Skyline. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers. 100 million angels singing. Multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum.